So yes, I started working at the London Buddhist Centre, and still in 1984, and I worked there with a man called Colin Lavender, who later became Sue Mangala, and he was a very close friend of mine for many years. And there are many, many others over the years who've helped me, befriended me, being there to listen to me and so on. People like, some of these names you won't know, but I want to read out the names anyway, just to say, the Satya Bandhu, Vimala Bandhu, who is here, many of you will know, Maitreya Bandhu, and, well, there are just so many people, so many names that I could read out. And, you know, and it's still going on. I myself now am a spiritual friend or a guide or whatever, helping people to get ordained and so on, a preceptor to many people. And I think three of them here tonight who I will be ordaining at some time, Pete, Pedro and Dougie. And I hope I can give to them something of what I've gained from others over the last 30 years. I'd say spiritual friendship is one of the main gifts that I've received from my involvement in Sri Ratna. And it is a gift. It's a gift, actually, whether you're receiving it or giving it. It's a gift. I experienced, actually, the very idea of spiritual friendship as a gift, both the idea and the practice, a gift from Bhante Sangharakshita. And for that reason, I also consider him to be a spiritual friend to me over the last 30 years. So looking back like this over 30 years and remembering all those friendships and connections which are woven into the tapestry of my life, considering all the friendships and connections that I have now in my life, and even reflecting on all the connections that I will have, that I will encounter in the future, I feel very rich. I think of it as, this is where the wealth is in my life. My wealth is not in property. I don't have any. It's not in bank accounts, but in friendships, in relationships. It's other people who give my life a sense of richness and abundance. And when I look at all these connections, all these relationships, I have a sense of a flow of spiritual friendship from Bhante Sangharakshita to people like Subhuti, Attila, Dhanavira, from them to me, from me to others, and from those others to more and more people, and so on. It's like a great river of spiritual friendship, Kalyanamitrata, flowing on down the generations. Or to use a different image, it's like a matrix of connections stretching over space and time and encompassing the lives of many, many people. And what this is, what it's all about is people communicating with other people. And what's being communicated is the experience of the Dharma, the experience and the understanding of the Dharma, the message of the Buddha. It's been passed on through relationships of one kind or another. You could say that Dharma is given life, it's animated by being practiced, and those who practice begin to embody the Dharma, and it's this living, breathing Dharma that gets passed on through Kalyanamitrata, through spiritual friendship. Now, the Buddha was the original spiritual friend. He refers to himself in the Saṅyutta Nikāya, in the Pali Canon, he refers to himself as a spiritual friend, as a Kalyanamitra. And after his enlightenment, he sought out people he could communicate with. It's as if enlightenment demands communication. Spiritual development needs to be communicated. Spiritual experience needs to be communicated. So he sought out people he could communicate with. And when his communication had as it were, gotten through to people and had transformed the hearts and minds of his first 60 disciples or friends, he asked them to go off and to communicate with others. And it's what it says in the text. He says to them, "Go now and wander for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and men. Teach the law that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the meaning and the letter. Explain a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. There are creatures with little dust on their eyes, and they will be lost through not hearing the law." So the Buddha's message to his disciples was to go forth, communicate with other people. In other words, become spiritual friends. That's what he's telling them. Become spiritual friends. Become Kalyanamitras to others. You have experience. You've gained something. You've learned something. Go and share it. In the Dhammapada, he teaches the importance of association with the spiritually mature. In verse 78, he says, "One should not associate with friends who are evildoers, nor with persons who are despicable. Associate with friends who are virtuous." And the words in Pali for friends who are virtuous are mitta kalyana. So it's the same words, kalyana mitra. So spiritual friendship is really right there at the heart of Buddhism, right there at the beginning of Buddhism. It's because of spiritual friendship that we've got Buddhism, as it were, that the Buddha communicated the Dharma. So in the beginning, our practice is really to be receptive to those who can guide us. Has to be the way in the beginning, because we have to learn how to practice, yeah? Later on, our practice is to be mutually supportive with those on the path with us. And later still, our practice is to share our experience and knowledge of the Dharma with others. So you could say this is Buddhism in a nutshell. Learn how to practice, share your practice or your experience of practice with others. That's Buddhism in a nutshell. And this is all about spiritual friendship. Friendship based on a common spiritual aspiration and a common spiritual practice. And spiritual practice, by the way, does not mean meditation practice. It doesn't mean just meditation practice. Meditation is only a small part for most of us. In a 24-hour day, we're probably asleep 7 hours. Maybe we meditate 1 hour, and then there are another 12 hours. And the other 12 hours are the really important part of the day for spiritual practice. Yeah. So what is spiritual practice, is the question that comes to mind. I think perhaps we need to answer the question, what do we mean by spiritual? And maybe based on our understanding of what the spiritual is, we'll be able to understand better what spiritual practice is and what spiritual friendship is, and how they relate to each other. And this also will help us to understand the relationship between spiritual friendship and ethics, which is the theme of this talk. This talk was called something like A Helping Hand, Spiritual Friendship and Ethics. So the spiritual in the Buddhist context is that which relates to states of consciousness which transcend our normal, mundane mind experience. So our mundane experience is fundamentally flavored by ego identity. According to the Buddha, this means that normal, mundane consciousness is characterized by greed, which is grasping after whatever will enhance our sense of self. So that's possessions, people, comfort, security, and so on. Normal mundane consciousness is also characterized by aversion. So that's pushing away anything that appears to threaten our sense of self. People, events, demands, and so on. And normal mundane consciousness is also characterized by a lack of wisdom about the true nature of reality. Even a willful turning away from the fact of impermanence, the fact that actions have consequences, the fact of our own delusion. So transcending this mundane mind, or going beyond this mundane mind, or transforming this mundane mind, means moving towards becoming more generous, abundant, non-grasping, non-attached, instead of being greedy and grasping. And it means becoming more loving, more kind, more open, more receptive, rather than being averse or hateful. And transcending our mundane mind means becoming wise and fully accepting of the impermanence of our self and of all things. Fully accepting of the need to change and grow and develop into a more expansive and mature human being. The essence of practice is repetition. To practice is to repeat something again and again. So just as a musician practices or an athlete practices, so spiritual practice is the repeated activity of body, speech and mind which enables us to attain the spiritual. Or to put it another way, spiritual practice is the repeated activity of body, speech and mind which enables us to transcend egotism. Transcend our egotism and to grow into, eventually into embodiments of wisdom and compassion. And spiritual friendship is the friendship between people who are committed to and engaged in spiritual practice. So these repeated activities, the repeated activities that enable us to overcome selfishness or egotism, they're acts of giving, acts of kindness, words of kindness, truthful, helpful, harmonizing words, thoughts of kindness and generosity, and all that in a context of growing awareness. As our awareness grows, our activities, our actions of body, speech and mind become more sensitive to others and more subtle. So awareness is developed through meditation. It's developed through meditation in conjunction with and in interaction with other people who share our aspirations and practices. So we need both of these things. We need, as it were, the internal work and the external work. We need to be working on our minds and we need to be working on our interaction with the world. If meditation is isolated from the context of interaction, the context of communication, if it's isolated from that, it can, in the worst case, lead to greater delusion rather than greater awareness. So that's why spiritual friendship is so important. There's always a temptation in our spiritual lives to think that we really will make progress if we take ourselves off somewhere and meditate for a long period of time. And that's not untrue, but it's not the whole truth. Yeah? The whole truth is that we need to meditate, we need to work on our minds, but we also need to work on the connection, the communication, the contact with other people. We need to work on ourselves in relation to others. We need to be aware of that self that's in interaction with other selves, as it were. That's where real spiritual progress is made. So a spiritual friend in the form of a teacher or a guide can help us to understand our own experience better and can help to prevent us from interpretations that don't lead to spiritual growth. So one of the big kind of enemies of spiritual growth is our own interpretations of our experience. If our interpretations are just our own interpretations, they're quite likely to be wrong. So our interpretations of our own experience need to be checked out with other people, and preferably with people who are more experienced, if possible. Spiritual friends who are on the same level, as it were, of experience can support us through difficult times and help with the mutual exploration of experience. And spiritual friends who are less spiritually experienced provide a context in which the truth of our spiritual insights are tested. Are we really more aware, more honest, open, kinder, more generous than we were before? This is what's tested when we begin to share our experience with others. So the big test of our growing spiritual maturity is not whether we can focus on the tip of our nose for half an hour. It's not whether we have peak experiences of bliss when we meditate. It's not whether we can sit in meditation for 10 hours a day. I think these things are all valuable. They can be very valuable. It can be a great boost to our spiritual practice. But the real test, what's of real significance, is what happens, as I say, in our interactions with other people. When our actions, when our words and our mental states become more kusala, skillful, kusala. Kusala is mental states which are based on love, kindness, generosity, wisdom. So when our actions, words, and mental states are more kusala, then we're truly making progress in the direction of higher states of consciousness. We're beginning to embody the spiritual and becoming spiritual beings. Ethics is the word that we often use to translate kusala, or other words in the Pali, sila, sikapada. Kusala means skillful, as I said, as opposed to unskillful, which is actions coming out of greed, hatred, and ignorance. Sikapada is the training principle. So our precepts are often called training principles. And kusala is how a spiritual being behaves. So someone who has realized the true nature of reality, whether that's what we call a stream entrant or a Buddha, they are kusala, they're skillful. What they do is kusala, what they say is kusala, and what they think and feel is kusala. So kusala describes the world of a Buddha. So when we decide that we want to grow and develop and move in the direction of Buddhahood, we start by trying to make our actions kusala, making our words kusala and our minds kusala. And the most fundamental act that moves towards Buddhahood is the act of giving, because it transcends self-centeredness. Giving is, you could say, the basis of kusala. So that's in terms of actions. In terms of words, it's honesty that's most basic. And in terms of thoughts and feelings, it's metta, loving-kindness, which is most basic. So the foundations of our spiritual life are giving, honesty, and metta. It's quite simple in a way. Well, it's quite simple to say. Yeah? Giving, honesty, and metta. And we need to practice these towards ourselves and towards others. Yeah. So spiritual friends are an essential ingredient in any life dedicated to spiritual practice and the attainment of Buddhahood. So in the first instance, they're essential because we can learn from them. Without the Buddha, there would be no Dharma. Without Bhante Sangharakshita, there would be no Tri Ratna community and Tri Ratna order. Without the Tri Ratna order, there would be no Cambridge Buddhist Center. Without the creation of the Cambridge Buddhist Center, you would not be listening to me here tonight. So the flow of spiritual friendship from the Buddha down the generations has found expression in this event that's happening right now. The kindness and generosity of many, many people have led up to this moment. A second reason why spiritual friends are essential is that it's only through communication that we can really gain self-awareness. And by communication, I mean confiding in others so that we're not burdened by secrets, as it were. By communication, I mean confessing our unskillfulness, so we're not burdened by a bad conscience. By communication, I mean giving expression to our experience and our understandings of the Dharma, so we don't fall into wrong interpretations. And above all, by communication, most important, I mean listening. It's through listening, really, that our awareness and sensitivity grows stronger. So that's the second reason. Communication helps us to gain self-awareness. The third reason why spiritual friends are essential is that they are aware of us. So we're trying to realize, to penetrate into the true nature of reality. And we do this by reflecting. So often we can reflect on concepts such as impermanence or karma, actions having consequences. We meditate. We engage our imagination with the qualities of the Buddhas. We train ourselves in ethics. And all of these help us to see into reality. But other people have the unique quality of being able to return our awareness. So what we are and who we are is much more surely reflected back to us by others than by any concept, image, or experience. To some extent, we can control our reflections. We can even control our experiences and our interpretations to some extent. But we cannot control another person's awareness. So if we're open to it and willing to explore it in the spirit of a spiritual adventure, as it were, we can gain a huge amount from hearing and seeing and experiencing how other people respond to us. And with close friends, of course, we can invite them to tell us how they experience us and then reflect on that as an aspect of reality. So spiritual friends are essential to spiritual practice because we learn from them, because we can communicate with them, and because they're aware of us. Now, as I said at the beginning, I first became a Buddhist through a brief encounter with a Buddhist monk. And what impressed me most was not what he said to me. What impressed me most, actually, was the congruency between what he was saying and how he was living his life. It was the fact that he was actually putting into practice what he was talking about that really touched me. And it drew a very deep response from me. Well, it drew a response from me which has shaped my life ever since, for the last 30 years. So you could say that's the power of the person. That's the power that of the effect that we can have on each other. That, you know, we can shape each other's lives, as it were. We can have a very powerful effect on each other. And the right word at the right time. After all he talked to me about was the five precepts and the Metta Bhavana. Most of us are very, very familiar with that. For me at the time, it was completely revelatory. It was a revelation. And yes, it drew a deep response. And then reading Subhuti's book, Buddhism for Today. In that case, it was the ideas to some extent, but it was also the fact that what I was reading was I was reading about people who were living out the ideas. So I had no illusions at that time about idealistic people. I had lived with lots of idealistic people when I lived in West Berlin. And I knew that idealistic people could be very nasty, yeah? At the same time as being very idealistic. I'm sure actually at the time I could be very nasty at the same time. So that was my experience. But the fact that these idealistic people that Subhuti was writing about were trying to put their ideas into practice, that they were creating Buddhist centers, creating communities, creating team-based right livelihood businesses. I was deeply impressed by that. Actually, I still am. I'm still deeply impressed when I see people doing these things. When I see the work being done, say, here by Vajradevi and Sagar Ghosh and Tejaswini to provide all of these facilities and all of these events for us. I'm impressed. I'm impressed and inspired. And when I reflect on how many other people throughout the Sri Ratna community are doing all around the world, are doing these kind of things, I'm even more inspired and impressed. I've just been looking at the internet, the reports back from the Order Convention in India, and it's just very inspiring. They had representatives from, I think, 19 or 20 countries there from the Order, and all of these people are working to share their experience of the Dharma all around the world. And then, as I said earlier, when I got involved with the Sri Ratna community, the first Order member I met was Dhanavira, and he was so kind to me. He found me a place to live in a small community where he was living himself. He looked out for me, he befriended me, and through him I saw generosity in action. And I learned some of the fundamentals of the spiritual life. I also learned, incidentally, that I shouldn't take people for granted, because at the time I had a habit of making decisions without telling anybody. Yeah. So, for instance, I was living with Dhanavira. I decided to ask to become a Mitra. I never told him. And I was actually living and working with him, so I was spending a lot of time with him. And I think he found this a bit strange. In fact, I think he found it a bit upsetting that I didn't actually communicate to him about what I was doing. And I learned from that friendship is not just something you can be a passive recipient of. You have to engage and communicate and reveal your thoughts and feelings. In a way, not to do so was not skillful, not kusala. It was not being sensitive to the and taking into account another person's feelings. And then again, I mentioned Attila, who was another friend I learned from early on. And the main things I learned from him were the importance of being aware of people, the importance of listening, and listening not just with your ears, as it were. So being aware of people through observing them, through all sorts of ways you can become aware of people. And the importance of being aware of your own emotions and motivations. And Attila was another exemplar to me, an exemplar of kindness, an exemplar of generosity, of which I was a direct recipient. And I found that being on the receiving end of generosity, kindness, help, friendship, it made me question my view of myself, which at the time was actually quite negative. Yeah, other people treated me better than I treated myself. Other people thought more highly of me than I thought of myself. Other people could see the good and the valuable in me that I couldn't see in myself. And in this way, other people contributed very directly and tangibly to the whole process of spiritual development for me. Attila, she was probably the person who had the biggest impact on me at that time. And I'm extremely grateful to him. So I was learning from others, learning from what they said, from how they acted, they exemplified something for me. And of course, also they explained many things to me. And this is skillful action on their part, kusala karma. And I was learning about what kusala means through experiencing it from others. Spiritual friendship, as it were, conveyed ethics or conveyed the kusala, the skillful, to me in the most direct way. And of course, at the same time that I was learning from people who were more spiritually experienced, I was also exploring, discussing things, practicing alongside friends who were at the same level, as it were, to me. Again, names that you won't know: Sumangala, Aryaguna, Satchabandhu, Vimalabandhu, you may know, many, many more. So we were, at the time, 30 years ago, young men who no doubt competed with each other furiously at times, but we were also very open and honest with each other. And from that the one thing I learned is that I shared a lot in common with others. So my struggles were not unique to me. My idealism was not unique to me. My confusion was not unique to me. And I found it immensely helpful to be able to share all of me with at least some other people. And to know them deeply enough to see, in a way, to see what was universal in our experience. And I also learned from these friends that we all have different strengths and weaknesses, and therefore we were all able to help each other in different ways. We all struggled. I don't know if people struggle these days. We all struggled, and we had confusions and so on. But actually, our struggles were always different, as it were. One might struggle with understanding, and another might struggle with faith or concentration or whatever. We all struggled with different things, and so we could help each other. So we could all explore what was skillful, what was kusala, and what was not kusala, and confide and confess when we were falling short, or even when we were just unsure, which was probably more often. And after I was ordained in 1988, increasingly I found myself in the position where others were looking to me to explain and exemplify kusala karma, skillful action. And this is challenging if you engage with it. It encourages you to become a bigger and a better person, just to be able to guide or give guidance to others. And actually, I trust that many friends have benefited from my explanations and my example. And the reason I trust it is because that's what they've told me many, many times. But I've gained a great deal also from those friends, the people to whom I have been a Kalyana Mitra, a spiritual guide, a preceptor, whatever. I've gained a great deal from them. They've inspired me and heartened me. And seeing them make progress on the spiritual path has been, I would say, probably a source of profound joy to me. And it's enhanced my faith in the Buddha Dharma. Friends like Priyavajra, Dana Priya, Satchadasa, Maitri Gosha, who's here, and many, many others. People I've seen growing and changing from their early tentative steps on the path, and growing into people who have become substantial guides and exemplars themselves. It's such a delight to see this. It's such a delight to see people changing and growing in the spiritual life. Together with those friends, I've explored and continue to explore the spiritual life and what's skillful and so on. It keeps my own ethical sensitivity alive. And it keeps happening. There are others, as I said here this evening, there are people who've asked me to ordain them. And before my very eyes, I see them growing. And because of previous experience, I have a good sense of what they can and will become. Pedro, Pete, Dougie. All very sincerely, energetically on the path, and all thoroughly engaged with trying to practice and explore what is Kusala. And encouraging and guiding and helping these men is a big part of my spiritual practice and a big inspiration and encouragement to me. I'm coming near the end, so don't get... Traditionally, the relationship between spiritual friendship and ethics, which is what I'm supposed to be speaking about, is spoken about in terms of apatrapia, or ottapa in Pali. And usually this is envisaged as what happens in spiritual friendship between someone who is more spiritually experienced than someone who is less spiritually experienced. Apatrapia is the emotion that arises for the less experienced person when they're unskillful, and they bring to mind the person who is their guide or teacher. So you could say it's a feeling of having let themselves down, or having let down their friend and guide. It's a pang of conscience that's heightened by the thought of the teacher or friend. Sometimes it's translated as shame. I don't think that quite gets it, really. Shame's got kind of strange connotations. It's more like a sense of regret accompanied by a resolve to do better next time. So it's a kind of strengthening emotion. It's building the muscles of kusala behavior. And the example of the teacher, the example of what's possible, helps that process. So I've been trying to clarify what spiritual friendship is and how it relates to spiritual practice and how that connects with ethics, with kusala karma. And I've used examples from my own life to try to describe the process of spiritual friendship, how it gives rise to actions, words and mental states, which are kusala. And I've also tried to make clear the fundamental importance of to spiritual progress of actions and words and thoughts which are skillful, which are kusala. So before I finish, I want to go in just a little bit more detail using the five precepts as a framework. And then I'll finish, yeah? So the first precept is about refraining from harming living beings. Or to put it positively, it's about engaging in acts of loving kindness. And the first recipient of your loving kindness needs to be yourself. That's the form of the practice, the metta bhavana practice, indicates that. Your loving kindness overflows out to others, but you need to have it for yourself. However, sometimes it's easier, more practical in a way, to start by developing loving kindness for good friends. Many people find it easier to get in touch with, as it were, their goodwill towards their friends, and then, as it were, treat themselves as a friend. Yeah? Also by acting in ways that are kind and helpful, even though we're not experiencing the mental state of kindness, by being kindly and helpful in our actions, we can cause kindness to arise. We tend to think that mental states are primary and our actions come or emerge out of our thoughts and emotions. And that's true. However, it's also true in our experience, we can see it, that if we act as if we were experiencing kindness, love or generosity, the action will influence our minds and lead to states of mind that can then flow out into more acts of kindness and so on, a kind of positive spiritual momentum. So if we actively befriend people by being kind to them, we will benefit from that ourselves in many ways. The second precept is about not taking what is not freely given. So that's how it's usually stated. More positively, it's about giving. And the connection between spiritual friendship and giving is quite clear. Spiritual friendship is all about giving. Giving material things, giving help, assistance, giving encouragement, giving praise, giving criticism even, giving our experience, giving our talents, our gifts. And generosity is always kusla. Well, not everything that looks like generosity is kusla, of course. Sometimes people may give money or property or time, but without stating it, they're expecting something in return. So that if one is giving and expecting a return, then it isn't really giving in a kusala sense. It's more like making a down payment or something like that, if you're expecting a return or a reward. Friendship is not a transaction. It's not a bargain. And it only really works well when you're not expecting or demanding a return. Paradoxically, I suppose you could say the less you want from friendship, the more you can get. And the more you want, the less you get. It's a bit like in the Bodhicharya Avatara, Shantideva talks about happiness in that way. He says people suffer because they seek their own happiness, and they're happy when they seek the happiness of others. You can apply that same principle to friendship. The third precept is about refraining from sexual misconduct, and more positively, it's about contentment. So sexual misconduct is it's about that whole Surrey business whereby human beings use violence, coercion, emotional blackmail, exploitation, and manipulative behavior of one kind or another to satisfy sexual desire. Contentment is about dealing with the dissatisfactions that underlie our overemphasis on sexual relations. You could say there are two levels to our, or two aspects, let's say, to our fascination with sex. There's the level of the basic animal drive. And much of civilization, actually, is about bringing a measure of control and discipline to that basic animal drive. Every human society has its rules and norms to regulate this basic drive. And the rules and norms can vary hugely. What is or is not acceptable can vary enormously. And these rules of society are often tied in with questions of property ownership and peaceful relations between clans or tribes or nations. So that to breach the rules is not just a personal matter, but something that affects the stability of society. Then the second level, or the second aspect to our fascination with sex, is about is more emotional and psychological. In order to have sex, you have to be physically intimate with someone. And this physical intimacy becomes a way into emotional intimacy. However, physical intimacy is not emotional intimacy. And all sorts of problems can arise when a society accepts and encourages the view that physical intimacy is emotional intimacy. Or aligned with that is the view that there cannot really be emotional intimacy without physical intimacy. And this is the view that has grown up in many societies over the last couple of hundred years. So sex has become, to some extent, divorced from questions of property and alliances, and has become much more a question of a search for emotional fulfillment, at least in Western countries. This is what sometimes referred to as the romantic ideal. And the positive side of this is that people are not forced into unsuitable relationships or relationships that are repulsive to them, which did happen and does happen in parts of the world still. The downside is a more psychological one, is that it can overload one relationship with too many expectations. especially a relationship that's built on what could be the shaky foundation of physical attraction and physical intimacy. And the spiritual community can help, as it were, by being a further source of emotional fulfillment. When we have friends with whom we are emotionally intimate, it can take some weight off our relationship where we're physically intimate. It helps us, as it were, to lower the expectations we have of our sexual partner, which can also help us to become more content. Contentment, you could say, is a state of feeling rich and fulfilled, so that there isn't a constant aching yearning for something more or someone more. If we're content and feeling emotionally rich, there is less temptation for us to try to manipulate others for our satisfaction. The fourth precept is about avoiding falsehood and being truthful. Being truthful is not so easy, and probably all of us have at some time or other in our lives told lies, either large or small. Sometimes we lie to gain some advantage. Sometimes we lie to avoid conflict. Sometimes we lie to be polite. Sometimes we tell lies for no discernible reason at all. Perhaps it just gives us a sense of power. But at some time or other, we've probably all done it. And sometimes we lie most to our nearest and dearest. Husband, wife, parents, children, partner, lover, siblings. We lie to keep the peace, to avoid upsetting people, and so on. So what's the problem with being untruthful? If telling lies can help to keep the peace, avoid conflict, avoid upsetting people, what's so wrong with that? Well, it removes the basis for a relationship. It removes trust. If we've been on the receiving end of lies and deception, we probably all know what it feels like and how it changes our view of the person who has lied to us or deceived us. It leaves us unsure of what is or is not true. We're unsure of what to trust. We start to think, if that bit of the picture is not true, could it be that there is more that's false? What can we trust? We find that what we thought was solid ground is actually not so solid. So being deceived can be much more upsetting than whatever the deception was trying to hide. I was thinking of some, as it were, more extreme examples of this. Sometimes in families, a parent, for instance, may not want to upset the children by telling them about something like a diagnosis of cancer or something like that. And of course, that deprives them of the opportunity to give their love and support, and also the opportunity to come to terms with, well, the probable loss of a mother or father. And it can be very heartbreaking to be deceived in that way. Or on the other side, sometimes when someone is seriously ill, perhaps a parent or something like that, the children or relatives insist that they're going to get better. They keep saying, oh, you know, you'll improve, you'll get better, or whatever. But it's obvious that that's not the case. And that can also be, well, it can make the process of letting go and dying much, much more difficult than it needs to be. So even lies that are told with, as it were, very good intentions can have very unfavorable consequences. Now, by definition, spiritual friendship has to be based on truthful communication. There can be no spiritual friendship if what's communicated is false or is meant to deceive in some way. So deceiving a spiritual friend is, in the end, self-deception. And spiritual friendship, and it can be a context in which we learn to be more and more honest. And that includes being honest with ourselves. So the fifth precept is about avoiding things that cloud the mind and developing more mindfulness. So when we're practicing kusala karma, skillful action, in the context of spiritual friendship, we're developing awareness of others through observing and listening to them, and we're developing awareness of ourselves by being reflected back. Intoxication with alcohol or drugs or whatever, is a method, you could say, of becoming less aware. It's a method of becoming less aware and of avoiding our inner life. And therefore, it's not compatible with spiritual friendship. So all the precepts together are kusala karma, skillful action. And they enhance spiritual friendship and are enhanced by spiritual friendship. Now, one last thing. In this talk, which is on the theme of spiritual friendship and ethics, I've tried to avoid the word ethics as much as possible. I've also avoided the word morality, and I've even avoided the phrase training principles. I don't find any of these terms quite satisfactory. Ethics, to me, sounds like a sort of academic discipline. Morality conjures up images of a disapproving deity. And training principles, well, that could be about weightlifting or business management or something like that. So I've opted instead for kusala karma, skillful action, or simply kusala, skillful. Kusala is a word that's easy to say. It has a pleasant sound, I think. And as Buddhists, we're free to, as it were, clothe it in positive connotations, just as we have, for instance, done with the word metta. I don't know, perhaps it'll catch on, so that we can speak of our practice of kusala karma, or even of trying to be kusala. And it will carry connotations of positive emotion, of friendliness, of awareness, of honesty, kindness, generosity, lots and lots of positive connotations. It could become for us a word so rich in meaning that just to hear it would be uplifting. A word just like friendship. Friendship is a word which is uplifting just to hear it. It carries so many positive connotations. Friendliness, friend, friendship, all very positive words. And what they stand for, of course, is even more positive. Spiritual friendship is wholly positive and a source of great joy, great happiness. And kusala karma is also wholly positive and a source of great joy. So it's important to understand that spiritual friendship and kusala karma are completely intertwined, and that both are the fertile ground out of which spiritual insights grow. So if we understand this, if we act on it, then spiritual progress is inevitable, we could say. And all our insights, all our understandings will have a stable basis in the reality of human interaction and the reality of actions having consequences. So that's all I want to say. Thanks.